For those who don't know me, my name is Nick Randolph, and I've been a Windows platform developer for, well, countless years. But this is the only year that I've really felt like I can actually truly say that, because now that we're one unified platform, I get to build for all of these great Windows devices. Yesterday's session, for those who were at it, I kind of did very sort of high-level stuff. Unfortunately, whilst this is kind of pegged as a 400 session, the reality is that nothing about Windows platform development is actually that complicated. So it's not conceptually very difficult. The places where we do find things are a little harder is just when documentation fails or we find bugs in the tools that don't necessarily do the right things. And I'll talk about some of those, particularly around things like Cortana, where unless you've downloaded update 1 for Visual Studio, you'll rack your hair out until you realize that actually what's causing you problems is the tooling, and that you're doing everything that you want to do correctly. So this isn't overly hardcore. It is 400 session mainly because it goes into more advanced things than what we covered in the previous talks. We will touch on various different areas, so there might be this feel that this is a little disconnected. The main reason for that is I wanted you to touch on some of the important areas that we've come across whilst we're doing Windows 10 development, and draw your attention to some of those. And what's going to be really interesting is the first section of this, we're going to talk about the web. What's really interesting about the web is if you look at the choice of cross-platform technologies, the web keeps on coming up as an option, okay? And on one hand, we have things like PhoneGap and we have mobile websites, and there's great ways of encapsulating, you know, a mobile-enabled website as a UWP wrapper. I'm not going to go into those that per se, but there are some other alternatives to using the web within our universal applications that I wanted to go through. The first one is actually to use the built-in JavaScript engine that comes with Edge, which is Chakra, and actually embedding it within your application. You might be going, why on earth would I want to do that? Well, if you look at where the .NET framework and where particularly the unified platform is going, we're moving away from having dynamic capabilities within our application. You know, back in the Silverlight, the WPF days, even back in the Windows Forms days, we could dynamically load DLLs, we could do all sorts of fancy creative stuff using Reflection, Injection, and stuff like that to really extend or provide extension capabilities for our application. If you look at the direction the store is going, it's going completely the other direction. No longer are we shipping IL. We now ship .NET Native, which is native code, right? There's not a chance in hell that you're going to be able to actually inject stuff into there, right? So one of the interesting things that JavaScript gives us is the ability to dynamically load effectively text and get it to load dynamic objects. Those objects might change over time. So all the dynamic aspects of JavaScript we can get by embedding the JavaScript engine into our application. And this isn't a high-level JavaScript engine. This is the same engine that you get out of IE, right? So it's a really high-performant JavaScript engine. And you can embed it in your application. You go through the blogs that talk about this stuff, and it's not overly easy to follow. Mainly because there's a whole bunch of redirection that needs to happen to go through in order to get to the point where you can actually load your JavaScript and actually get it executed. So they haven't done a really good job of packaging it. There is a good sample that's up there, although we found some issues with that. Hopefully, what I'll walk through today is I'll show you that there is a wrapper out there. I've actually blogged about it, so you can go and grab the code off there, that actually gives you a great starting point for actually doing that. And I'll show you, like in 10 lines of code, how you can start up an instance and actually open and close sessions so that you can actually separate one session from another in the same instance of your application to get it to different things. Okay, the next thing, in terms of the web, of course, we've got the ability to host a web view. Now, what's really, really interesting thing about here is the support for bidirectional communication between the web view. If you've ever done hosting of web browsers or web views in the past, you've had this narrow channel to do things through. And so if you're communicating into the web to the website, you've basically got a method that says, hey, invoke this JavaScript command. And the route out of the web view is basically you call like notify window, and then you have a single exit point, which is basically an event. One of the really nice things about the event, the web view in Windows 10 is that you can actually register callback objects. Okay, so you can effectively, it's got to be a WinRT component, so you've got to have a separate library that's actually a WinRT component, and that's where your class lies. But you can then effectively register that object with the web view, and it'll actually, you know, from your JavaScript code, you've actually got a very rich interface that you can then communicate back out into your native code or your managed code with. The next thing is, of course, a web application, and I talked about this a little yesterday. It's basically the ability to if you go through the templates, it's actually the WinJS project, okay? So you go File New Project, WinJS Project, and what you do is you basically select all of your content files and you go Delete, And then you go into your package manifest file and you say, hey, the entry point for my application is this URL. And you can do some creative things, like you can basically say, okay, well, I want these specific URLs to be trusted. And what that effectively means is that those anything loaded from those URLs, whether it be JavaScript or HTML, can then make call-outs to some of the WinRT objects. And this gives you some quite nice capabilities around doing things like live tiles. It gives you nice ability to integration into Cortana. And it basically means that you can take your mobile website and give it some of those Windows 10 capable features. And so I've got a couple of demos that we'll go through there. So let me switch over to demonstrate a couple of these things. Right, so let's skip out of that. Okay, so this is our JavaScript host. And let me just show you it very briefly. It's basically a very simple application. And what I can do on the right is basically write some JavaScript, and when I run it, let's just resize the window so you can actually see the button at the bottom of it. Okay, so I can run some JavaScript over there and I can get some results. I can then go and modify that and say x equals 1, and I can put, just to verify that it is actually writing JavaScript and it's not doing basic arithmetic, and I can do x plus y and run that. Okay, so we're getting the results on the right-hand side. Now, what's really interesting here is that I can then assign that, so I can do var z equals x. Unfortunately, in the text box, it tries to do sensible things like spell check. So I've got a variable z. If I actually delete this and go z and just try and evaluate that, it's actually not going to give me a value for that. So what's interesting here is it's not just a single REPL loop. It's actually, every time I hit that button, it's actually creating a new session for me. So what I did in the previous one is not accessible from the next one. So I'll show you very quickly in code what that looks like. So when I instantiate my project, okay, my application, inside my view model, I'm actually creating an instance of the runtime. Now, I've abstracted all of this stuff away so that I've still got my nice separation from my UI, my view model, and I've got a wrapper layer that basically exposes that into the view model so I can go and create an instance of that runtime. I'll just show you the depths of the runtime, and you can see here that it goes, it's got a whole bunch of wrapper stuff. Most of it wrappers this class called Native, and in here I've got a whole bunch of references to, as we go down here, you'll see that there's some nice stuff, but effectively we've got the old DLL import. Okay, so these are basically references through to the actual engine that we're talking to. Let's bubble that back up and look at my view model again. What you've then got from your runtime, and you only load one instance of your runtime, what you then create from there is a series of contexts. And it's the context that basically is, and you can see here that I'm actually creating a context and then a scope, and those are wrapped in a using statement. So as I go and execute my code, I'm creating a new context every time I go and execute that code. Okay. That's the level I'm going to go to with that example. If you want to grab the code afterwards, it's a great starting point for actually getting started with using that engine. The other thing I'm going to show you is the ability to host a mobile website. So here we've got some code that's actually got a mobile website down the bottom, and we've got essentially an application that's got a bunch of content just to show icons and splash screens and things like that, but we've got actually no code in here. The core of it is actually this AppX manifest, so if I actually go and take a look at that. I did want the code version. Okay, and you can see here that it's got a starting point. Okay, so let me just go and run that. This is a very ordinary application because it actually looks like a website. Okay, so you can imagine here this has got some nice layout logic that actually makes it look more application-like. The interesting here is this show alert. This alert box that actually is coming up here is actually a native alert box. And how it's doing that is if I look at the code that actually gets executed when I do that, you'll see that it's actually launching, let me see down here, show alert. It's actually using a message dialog, which is the same dialog, message dialog class that you'd use from your managed code. Now the interesting thing here is that not only can I do that, I can actually go and say, okay, well I've got no managed code to actually debug, but what happens if I want to debug the JavaScript that's actually invoked? I go into project properties, I get some wonderful things like that. Okay, so debug is script type only. That means that essentially I should be able to just put a breakpoint in here and go start. Okay, so that's my website, but let's actually look at my app. And there we go. And so I can set a breakpoint there and it will actually get invoked. Interestingly enough, you can do this with the WebView as well. So if you're running a managed app and you're actually hosting code within the WebView, again, you can actually set breakpoints in that code. It's a little harder to do. So for example, let me go back to the Chakra example and I'll actually show you there as well. So here, let me run this, okay. Now, by default, you'll notice that it's actually just, it's not doing anything web really. Okay, so I can't easily do that. At the moment, it's actually set to debug the managed code. So for example, here, if I put the breakpoint here and go here and do 1+1, and it invokes, it's actually hitting my managed breakpoint. It's not hitting the JavaScript code that I'm actually executing. If I want to do the JavaScript code, again, project properties, and hopefully it doesn't give me those errors this time, and I go manage code down to script, run this, and what we should see in the Solution Explorer is, let me just do this, we'll actually see over here that it's actually loaded that script block. Now, the interesting thing here is because I'm dynamically loading scripts, it's kind of a cyclic thing because I actually want to debug the script that I'm just loading, but I won't be able to get a debug session going until I actually load the JavaScript, okay? So there is a trick to this. And so you think, okay, well, I don't know whether, I'm not really a web guy, but apparently if you do debugger, and not with a capital letter, and then you write some code, it's enough to actually get the debugger to try and attach to it. But there's a quirk here. You actually need to call the debugger twice in order to get Visual Studio to not only load the debugger, but actually set a breakpoint. So if I do that and you run that, well, it actually decides to hit the first of the two. Interesting enough, if I get rid of the second one, it doesn't hit it. You actually need to come back and do it again before it actually registers that that's what you want to do. So you can see over here that it's still loading these dynamic ones. It's actually still remembering the previous one, the set of code that you loaded, even though that context has kind of died because it's still one runtime. So it's a little confusing from that perspective. But you get the idea that you can now actually step through that code and you can actually see the JavaScript is evaluating. So that's a really useful tip in terms of actually working with web content. Okay, the next thing I want to talk about is Cortana. Okay, this is something that Microsoft loves to brag about, and of course it's now here in Australia. So if you've done the latest update, you now have it both on Windows 10 Mobile. Okay, so if you're on the phone, you've now got Cortana. There are a couple of things that haven't made it to Australia yet. Hey Cortana, so the ability for your phone to listen natively, currently doesn't work on the phone. On the desktop, and we'll get onto this in a minute, there's some things around the way that you integrate with Cortana that aren't quite there on the desktop. So latest build of Windows Desktop, if you've updated to Threshold 2, which is the major update, that's now got support for Cortana as well. So let me actually switch back. No, hang on, let's just step through that. The process of working with Cortana is actually not too dissimilar to voice commands that we had back in Windows Phone days. They've updated the schema that you use to define the voice commands to version 2. I think it's actually 1.2, but it's basically one step forward. But essentially, it's the same mechanism. So the voice command file basically says you define what your app name is or what the prefix for your command should be, and then you define a bunch of command sets. Now, the command sets are language and culture specific, right? So you could define a command set for US English, and a different one for UK English, and a different one for Australia English. The gotcha, I will give you the hint, is that there are some features of the one that's supported for US English that are not supported for Australian English. And so we had a couple of applications that were working really well. We could debug them. They're working really fine using Cortana because we had everything set to US English. We switched on to Australian English. Now that we've got Cortana support, everything started breaking. It was like we tracked it eventually down to the fact that these things weren't supported. I'll show you exactly which parameters they are. Take a look at the errors that come out of when you actually run the voice command or load the voice command, because it's unlike some other errors where they give you an error code, it actually tells you the exact thing to do. So a couple of my guys were scratching their head, why isn't it working? Why isn't it working? And eventually I told them, read the error message, okay? And they went, oh, and the error message is never useful. It was like, well, this time it actually happens to be, okay? So I'll show you what not to do there. So the basic process for using voice command is firstly, you need to go to the app manifest file and actually say that you want to use the personal, they call it a personal assistant. And so there's a specific extension that you want there. And essentially that gives Cortana the ability to launch your application. Now, Cortana can actually launch your application in two modes. It can either launch it in the foreground, or it can actually register launch a background task, okay? So you can actually say, hey, I don't necessarily want my application to launch, but I want you to call out to my background task that can actually then surface data back up into Cortana. Okay. This opens up a world of opportunities in terms of, again, not having to launch your application every time you want to do something. And this is one of the core focuses that they, or one of the areas where they spend a lot of time in terms of building out features for Windows 10. There's so many scenarios where your application can be a provider of a service or a provider of a capability, but you don't necessarily want to have to launch your application or launch the UI aspect of your application in order to give that capabilities to another application. Cortana is one example. Interactive notifications are another one. App services that we'll talk about in a little bit basically give you the ability to open up your application as a service to any other application that's also installed. Okay, so that's one important area. The voice command definition file is basically an XML file that you use to define those voice commands, starting with a voice command set, and then you work out a series of commands that you want to respond to. The important thing about that is it's an XML file. Out of the box, your managed code or your application doesn't know about that XML file. It's just a static content file that ships with your application. So you actually need to load it and so that the system actually understands about it. There's a slight difference between a managed application, a typical application that we'd build, and actually using the web wrapper. So the example I just showed there where I was registering a mobile website within my application, if you want to use Cortana there, actually, there's a meta tag that you put in your HTML to basically say, hey, here's my voice command file. Okay, same process, except the difference is that that voice command file will come from a server somewhere, as opposed to being packaged with your application. The next part is how you're going to respond to Cortana. And I mentioned this, you can respond in two ways. Both of them take basically the commands or the arguments that Cortana listens for and passes those through into your application. With the foreground application, so when your application gets launched in the foreground, it comes to the visuals, you're looking for the onActivated event or method that you're going to override at the application level. Just remembering that your application might already be running or it might have to be started to run. So don't forget to make sure that you create an instance of the frame and you load a page, otherwise the user won't have any interactive thing to work with. And lastly, don't forget to activate your window. I can't stress that enough. I said it yesterday, don't forget to activate your window. It's probably one of the most common errors that the developers new to the platform, or even developers coming from Windows Phone or Windows Desktop, if they don't do that, then you won't get a window and you'll be sitting there going, hey, but my application's running, I can debug it, but it's not on the visuals. So let me switch over again. For this section, I'm actually going to show you some of the samples there. So here we have the Adventure Work sample. The best way to get these is basically go to the UWP samples. They're all there, all 205 or something of them. This is actually, even though it's called Adventure Works, it's actually called something different. I think it's called the Cortana sample. Let me run that. And this is going to be the trick. I don't know that Cortana was listening to me. It definitely wasn't earlier. Right, so here we're basically doing two things. We're basically going to retrieve a reference to our voice command file. As I said, it's just an XML file that's packaged with the application. And then we're going to install the command files. Now, there is an extra step that this code actually does, and it goes and actually dynamically updates the destination. So this is weird. It's kind of called the AdventureWorks AdventureWorks sample, but it actually references flights to a location. Or anyway, it doesn't quite make sense to me. But anyway, they have got this ability to update a phrase list that Cortana is looking for. Okay, that doesn't make sense until I actually show you the command list. So here it is. All right, so this is the command definition file. As I said, it's got a command set, and you'll see at the top here that we've got the language reference. Okay, so this one's designed for Australian English. Now, interesting enough, this one does not ship with the sample. So if you're trying these samples today and you're running the Australian language on your machine and you've got Cortana and it seems to be working, but your app doesn't work, this is probably the reason why. Out of the box, it ships with US and UK English, and it's this parameter here that actually calls the spanner in the works. This particular option is not supported by the Australian at the moment. So all I've done is basically duplicate the US English, made it Australian English, and I've removed those parameters from the listen for statement. So I'll continue, let that run, but what I wanted to show you was these destinations. So my voice command ships with a very limited list of destinations. Now, the thing is, if I run this application up and I create a couple more entries in there, say, with different entries in the destinations list, I want to be able to update those dynamically. Luckily, you can do that, and it's very simple. Basically, this method here basically goes and I'll show you, it looks for a particular command set, okay? And it goes through and adds those to the phrase list and then goes and sets the phrase list. So it's basically updating that phrase list. One of the things you can't do is dynamically update the command list unless you go and completely generate the XML file and load it in again. Okay, so it's basically it's a replace all for the commands. So you can't just go and dynamically add the commands, but you can do a replace all if you load another XML file. Okay, so let me just show you the manifest file, because this is the other place where you need to know what to do. This particular parameter there is also shown in the nice user interface. Let me actually show you that. All right, so we've got this one here, and you're all going to go away, and you're going to load up Visual Studio 2015, and you're then going to email me, that option doesn't exist, Nick. It's coming in the update one, which is currently in RC. Right, if you're doing stuff with Cortana, you need to manually, you haven't got the update installed, you need to manually go into your code and you need to go in and add this line here. And then you need to be really, really, really careful that you never ever go into the designer for this, because the minute you go into the designer and you make a change, it's going to override it. What's worse? Okay, so you think, okay, I've done everything fine, I've tested it, it all works beautifully, I haven't gone into there, so I know that particular extension's there. I'm going to go and publish to the store. And by default, when you go through that process, it goes and says, do you want to dynamically update the version number? And you go, yeah, that sounds a good idea, okay. I'll leave that option checked. What does it do? Where's the version number stored for your application? It's stored right there. So what does the designer do as part of that process? It goes and modifies this file. Do you think it does it before it generates your package? No, it does it after. No, other way around. Does it do it after? It does it before. So it means it's going to update this file. It's going to get rid of that extensions, and all of a sudden you're going to publish your application and Cortana's not going to work. And you're going to be going, I'm sure that I made that change. Hey Cortana, show me trips to London. I told you, not always going to work. Actually, that's a user fail because I forgot to tell it which application I'm using. Hey Cortana, AdventureWorks, show trip to London.
Okay, showing trip to London.
Okay, so that's it loading into the foreground. Hey Cortana, AdventureWorks, when's my trip to London? Okay, bit of demo fail. Let me just make sure that I've got the right voice command. Okay, so this is actually a bit of a problem, right? You can be a great developer, but you can come up with the way that you'd want to present a particular voice command, but it may not be the way the person next to you is going to talk to Cortana, right? All right, let me see. When is my trip to... Okay, so, hey Cortana, AdventureWorks, when is my trip to London?
Looking for trip to London.
Step in the right direction.
Here's your upcoming trip.
Okay, so what it's done is rather than actually opening my application, I can the application is actually running, I think, but I can, just to prove a point, I can close that. And so it's still surfacing that data there. That's actually come from the background task. Go to AdventureWorks. No, she stopped listening to me. Right, okay. But the point there is that you can control that based on this navigate property. So you see here when I said show trip to London, the navigate property doesn't have a parameter there. There is actually a parameter there that can say load in foreground. If you want to load in the background, you need to make sure that you put in the voice command service and specify the target that you want to load. The target must correlate to the background task that you register in your app manifest file that's there, okay? So task is obviously going to be stored in a separate library, and if you look at the sample, there's this voice command service that's actually got a task in there, and this inherits from implements iBackground task. Okay, so you can see how all those things logically fit together. All right, next, interactive notifications, and kind of the new live tiles. I'll talk about those in a little bit as well. Interactive notifications. Again, they kind of work in the same way as app services and the Cortana integration. The idea there is that you've got an ability to work between an external application and your background task. And so interactive notifications are interesting from two fronts from that perspective. Firstly, the notifications can either be triggered locally, in which case you can be triggering it from a background task, prompting the user to do something and to respond, and then it gets fed back into your background task, or it gets fed back into your foreground task. The other interesting thing is that this can all be done remotely. Now, unfortunately, a number of the larger sort of aggregate notification services, things like Urban Airship, currently don't support the full suite of interactive notifications. I'm sure that will come in time. So some of these are going to be vendor lock-in. And so if you're using things like Urban Airship, you're going to have to wait until they provide extended support for this. But otherwise, if you're using things like the Azure Notification Hub, where you can basically define your own payload structure, you can actually start to take advantage of these today. In terms of the way that these are structured, and the way you've got to bear in mind that these notifications are designed to work on every Windows 10 device, right? So it doesn't matter whether it's phone, desktop, or whatever. The idea is that the notifications are structured in a way that they will need to render on each of those, right? So you don't have carte blanche access to say, hey, put this thing here, put this map here. You've got a very restricted layout through which you can work with. You do have image support, you do have things like drop-downs, and you do have things like push buttons and stuff like that, but they are somewhat limited. And lastly, you can ability to call into a background service to the user to interact with. Let me quickly jump over. And I'll show you the notification. I want to show you two things about the notifications. First of all, the notification sample. So you can drill down this, and this is actually the notification sample, and it covers both Toast and live tile updates. So you can drill into things like the live tiles and actually go through the process of pinning a secondary tile. And it's really good because it actually shows you what the payload structure is. For the life of me, I can never remember what these payload structures are supposed to look like. I always use the notification extensions out of NuGet. It's one of the sort of side projects that Microsoft worked on when they realized that most people don't like handcrafting XML. The Toast example is quite good. It shows you a bunch of different options around how you can lay things out. I'm just going to show you the launching a background task. So this is a Toast notification that's got an interactive capability. So I can go and modify this. I can hit submit, and that's actually going to call back into my background service so that it can then go forward from there. Nice thing about this is they've given you a button there to actually show you the payload, so you can actually go in and explore that. You'll see that the activation type for both of these buttons is to call into a background task. You can actually modify that, so you can have one that goes to background, one that goes to foreground. It's really up to you how you structure those. It does get a little complicated in terms of the XML structure, so here's some of the code that's actually in there. I'm not going to go through it in a great amount of detail. One of the things you might want to do is actually use this notifications visualizer. This is actually a store application you can go and download today, and it basically allows you to hack some XML so that you can play around with different structures for your live tiles and for your Toast notifications. And this is a great way of learning what's possible and what's not. I wanted to show you this for one particular reason, and this is this the ability to switch between devices, but the ability to show different densities. Now, yesterday I made mention of the fact that live tiles, we've now got a new set of templates that allow us to do adaptive layouts. And so what you're seeing on the left-hand side is basically, instead of actually defining things like text 01 and things like that, we're actually defining groups of text values or groups of things like text and images. And so let me switch back to the desktop so we can see that large one. You can actually see that I've got two big groups of data here, and they're laid out, you know, in the bottom tile. What's really interesting is actually I can take that same content and actually put it in this wide tile. So I'll just change it slightly. All right. Let's just make sure I grab the right amount of code. So I'll grab the two groups there, drop them into there. All right. And you'll notice I haven't really modified things over here because there's actually not enough space to do it. The reason I showed that is because when I switch to mobile doesn't support that large tile, but it does support multiple variants of density. So if you ever grab one of the really expensive phones with like a 1080p screen, and then you grab, you know, my, you know, sub-$300 640, those have actually got virtually the same screen size, except they've got a much different pixel density on them. So what you'll actually see is that they do make use of this on the start screen to actually show different amounts of contents, and that's where these adaptive layouts are really useful. So you see the lower, the wide tile there, as I vary the density, you're actually seeing different amounts of data. But notice that you're not seeing half that bottom group, It's either showing you the whole thing or showing you nothing. So as I grow that, it shows you the whole section of the bottom. And that's because you've got this ability to group text together. So this basically, it's blocked like that. So I'd highly recommend that you play around with this visualizer to get an idea of what's possible there. Okay. Let me quickly talk about app-to-app communication. Essentially, in the past, the only way that we could pass data or communicate between applications was using rather crude mechanisms. So we could either register a file extension, and so we've actually used this quite creatively in an internal product we've got called Builder Beta. We actually have a store-based application, and then we actually have a WPF-based application, and they both register for slightly different file extensions. And so we've got this rather crude way of switching between them. And so what we do is we actually log in using the store-based application. When you run the installer application that's actually WPF app, it redirects to the store-based one using a custom protocol to start with. And then the store-based one, if you haven't already signed in, it gets you to sign in. And then what it does is it actually encrypts your credentials or your key that you, as part of your signing in, you've got, and actually packages it as a file and then launches the installer, which is registered for a particular file extension. The installer goes, yep, okay, I've got all of that. It ends up creating another set of files that ends up passing back to the store. So we have it like this three chaining process, just because the only way we have to communicate between those two is via very crude mechanisms. There's a much better way now. We actually have an app service model. And so I've said here that you could launch an app service in the foreground or the background. Actually, technically, launching into the foreground, you're actually launching the application. You're not really launching an app service. But they kind of all tie into this new model or this new way of thinking. And so the really nice thing is here, you're not actually necessarily switching to the other application, particularly if you're launching in the background, because there would be no user interface. What you're actually doing is you're making a request to get it to do something. And as part of doing that, quite often you'll want a response to say, yes, I did it, or no, I didn't, or actually to generate a value and pass it back. And so if I take a quick look at this sample here for that, which I currently don't have open. Well, let me just open that. All right, so the sample for this basically has a number of different applications. It's got an app service client, app service provider, and then it's got a background service. So the background service is how you interact with the provider application. Okay, so let me actually just make sure that this is both going to run and deploy. Okay, good. Let me go and run both of those. So here we've got a couple of different options. The first one is a very simple mechanism where we're going to call off to our service provider, but actually we're calling the background task that belongs to that service provider, and it's going to generate a random number. Okay, so it's returned with a result. What's really interesting here is, so that's a one-off type thing. We're not creating an instance of it, we're basically just calling off to it. But we can actually maintain a connection to that background task. So if you think about the tasking model that goes on in the background, the first one was basically I call out to that background task. Background task does some work and then goes away. Okay, that is the background task that Windows has. In the second one, we're actually going to maintain a connection to that. So I can say, okay, we'll open a connection to it and do a couple of things. Okay, so generating a few random numbers. And then eventually I might want to close that connection. So you can actually have the second application running almost for the entire same life cycle as your application. But don't forget that it also is a managed application, right? So the framework could decide, okay, well, it's been running long enough, it's sitting there doing nothing, so I'm going to close it, okay? So just be mindful that you will need to have sort of almost like retry logic just in case that service disappears or closes on you, okay? Okay, let's take a quick look at the code for that. I'm not going to go into huge amount of detail, but let's just actually look at this one. So this is open and close. And so down here, okay, so create a new app service connection, and you can notice here a few things. So it's specifying both the service name and the package name, okay? So the trick here is that if you want to communicate with a particular package or a particular application, you need to know what its strong name is. You need to know what its package identifier is. What we're likely to see over time, and it won't happen overnight, is that we're likely to see applications publishing out a list of their services, right? if this doesn't happen, then it's going to be very difficult to explore and find out which packages or which services are available that you can call into them, okay? So somebody's going to set up a repository somewhere, I'd imagine, over time, which basically says, hey, there's a bunch of services that expose these kinds of interfaces, okay? And this is kind of the weakness of this model. In fact, it's been a weakness of the Android model since they came up with the concept of an intent. The Android model was very much you build separate little products or separate little applications or actions, and then people can tie together them by creating an intent that does a particular action or activity. And so this kind of model was really great in concept, but actually it was a complete fail from an Android perspective for about 5 years. Okay, it's only kind of recently that they've kind of worked out, okay, well, application developers now understand this concept and actually start to have some of this connection between these applications. Microsoft's just embarking on that. Hopefully they do a better job of communicating to developers. This is designed so that you can interact between applications. All right, one of my favorite topics. Caveat here, I'm not a designer, but I do spend a lot of time doing UX-related stuff. Okay. In fact, I would probably say 70%, maybe higher, of the time that we take to build an application is around UX. Okay. And actually, it doesn't matter whether it's a line of business or a consumer one. All that varies is basically whether it's 70% or 80%. If it's consumer, it's closer to 80%. If it's line of business, it might be closer to 70, maybe a little bit less. But the reality is that you spend a lot of time building out the user experience and getting it right. You know, page transitions, visual states, animations, they all take time and cycles. And as much as Microsoft are probably the leader in terms of tools, they're still nowhere near what they should be. You know, they're nowhere near the Photoshops of the world. They just do not make things easy. Coupled with the fact that, how many people here classify themselves as a designer? Right, nobody. Okay, awesome. Right, so we're all developers. Do you guys, any of you know how to use Blend properly? How do you make a storyboard in Blend? Anybody know? Oh, hey, we've got one person. Okay. If you asked me to write in XAML, I couldn't do it, okay? But I could do it in Blend, okay? Most people who start working with XAML eventually have to write XAML by hand, basically because the tools, as much as XAML was always created as a language that tools could understand and tools could implement things, the reality is that the tools don't keep up with the XAML, okay? Mainly because we've had Silverlight, WPF again, Windows Phone, Windows Unified Platform. Okay, so there's been so many different versions of XAML, and to make matters worse, Xamarin's just come out with their own Xamarin Forms, which is XAML, but it's not the same XAML that we're used to. So now, we've got their problem again. So it doesn't get better anytime soon. So let's go on to the topic. So in terms of where we are with the Unified Platform, yes, you can build an interface once and it's going to work everywhere. Okay, with the exception of a couple of things at the end, like IoT might not actually have a head, so it might not actually display any interface, and your lovely interface might not work particularly well on HoloLens because it's supposed to be a hologram. But the reality is that the XAML that you build will work on most of these devices. The question is, should it? Okay. Should the XAML that you've come up with for your beautiful phone-based interface work on a desktop that is the size of that screen that I'm looking at? No, it shouldn't, okay? If I put a phone interface on there, it's either going to be boxed in the left corner, right corner, or center stage, or it's going to be set to stretch and span the whole thing, which is going to look ridiculous, okay? So I'm going to want to do some fancy stuff to make sure that my user interface adapts. And for those people who sat through mine or Lars's session today, that there's a whole bunch of different techniques that we can use to actually adapt the user interface to accommodate for the screen size. One of the most crude ways of doing that is to have a completely separate XAML file. Now, I looked at this and I thought, okay, well, that's very crude. I don't really want to do it. Microsoft's not encouraging us to do it. Okay, I won't bother with that, okay? It'll be one of those things I stuff in my back pocket and I think, okay, if I ever need to use it, I'll pull it out. Having worked on a project where we did one adaptive user interface that works across everything from a 6-inch phone all the way up to big-ass screen like the one in front of me, the problem with that is it works beautifully on my Surface Pro or my Surface Book. The problem is when I run it on my sub-$300 device that doesn't have anywhere near the processing resource, even page transitions, and bear in mind, we've got no animations going on here, page switching, and I've even gone to the length of actually removing the basic transitions out of the page transition. Even that takes a couple of seconds, and I'm just going, this is really, really nasty. Now, we'll get into a couple of little methods later on that talks about deferred logic for XAML loading and things like that. But the reality is that sometimes the best method for actually getting performance is strip out everything that you don't need for a particular device family, load just what you need. The phone is actually really easy to build for. It's got a portrait, and then if you want to support it, it's got a landscape mode. The nice thing about phone is that you can be guaranteed that it's probably going to stretch from here to here, okay? And if you don't support landscape, it's going to be in portrait there and there, okay? The reality with the desktop is that you have to do portrait at this size, portrait at this size, portrait at this size, and then landscape at this size, and this size, right? So the reality is that you're going to have a lot of different layouts for the desktop that you won't necessarily want for the phone. And so by actually having a device family specific XAML file, you save yourself a bunch of time and you get a really high performing application out of it in the end, okay? So I'm not necessarily saying that that's the way to go, but just be pragmatic about the approach that you take. And the same goes if you've got an existing phone and an existing Windows application, be pragmatic about how you upgrade it to Windows 10. If those applications are working well, don't feel that you necessarily need to converge them all in one big hit into one application, because you're going to be there for 3 months rebuilding everything. Upgrade your phone to, if it's based on Silverlight, you're still going to have to do quite an upgrade cycle, but let's just say that it's built on WinRT for 8.1. You can upgrade that to Universal, but keep it as a phone application. You do the same with your desktop, you upgrade that to Universal, but you keep it as a desktop family specific one. You submit both of those packages to the store. Your end users are none the wiser. They think they're downloading the same app. But you know that you've actually got two separate applications that you're still managing. Now, over time, you'll converge those, and you know the next release and the next release, and maybe the release after that, you have one unified application. But again, it's a matter about being pragmatic about how you do that upgrade process. Okay, next thing, visual states with triggers. Okay, we talked quite a bit about that yesterday. In terms of using triggers to actually switch between layouts on the screen, and we'll do this again in the demo. Don't forget that you can create your own triggers, okay? So if you have a particular permutation of parameters, now, they could be air temperature for all I know, right? You might have different visual states based on, you know, the day of the week. It's completely up to you what you base those state triggers on. The one thing to be careful about this is that you're loading XAML. XAML is inherently slow. They have not done anything to improve the speed overall of XAML. Okay, they've done incremental improvements, but it is still inherently slow to load XAML and to run through any permutation of visual states. Because the other problem that we have with those big layouts I was just talking about is actually the number of visual states that we have there probably takes up the first two-thirds of the XAML file. Okay, the actual layout stuff is relatively small. The first two-thirds is actually all these complex visual states and the combination of those visual states. If you're introducing a lot of different triggers, you're actually going to slow down your overall thing. Now, it's actually not unreasonable to have all of those triggers, all those logic, actually buried further down in your application. And so don't think necessarily that all of your business logic has to be coming all these fancy new triggers. Keep the triggers just to doing their basic adaptive layouts, or you might have some which are basically family dependent, but keep those to a minimum. I still wouldn't recommend that you embed complex business logic in your triggers. That stuff still belongs in your view model, and if you need to drive state changes, which we do, out of your view model, do so by raising an event and getting the view model manager or the visual state manager to actually trigger those visual state changes. Okay, we have an extensive model where in our view model layer, we actually track what the current visual state is of the screen. We make a change in our logic, we actually update the visual state of the screen. Okay, we don't trigger things, we don't change visibility properties dynamically unless it's in a list. Most of the time we change the visual state, okay? The really nice thing about that is that that is 100% testable, okay? Your view layer is not easily testable, okay? Okay, controls. We mentioned these yesterday, but I'll talk about it again. The relative panel is a relatively new concept. It's not new for people coming from other platforms, but it is new to any form of sort of XAML. It is one that's really a stopgap just to encourage developers to come to the platform and get a familiar and use a control that they're relatively familiar with using. The split view is actually a nice control that we saw yesterday for actually having that sort of hamburger style menu. We're on Windows, so make use of them. I can't stress this enough, multiple windows. Now the biggest problem here, and we'll talk about view models or view model MVVM paradigms in a little bit, But the problem that we have with multiple windows is that they have multiple UI threads. Okay, so if you imagine you have window one or window two, you have view model one, view model two, you raise an event or you change the concept in or change a value in view model one and you need to raise a property changed event, that needs to be on the UI layer. Now if you've gone off and called services and you've done a whole bunch of stuff in the background, when you're bubbling it up and you need to switch back onto the UI thread, in the past we went something like core dispatcher dot, you know, get the one that's associated with the application, because we only had one window. And it was really easy to say, hey, give me the core window, okay, and give me the dispatcher that's on there, and right, I'm back on the UI thread. Brilliant. Okay, so imagine two windows, main view model goes, okay, well, give me a list of the windows. And it goes, okay, well, there's two windows, which one do you want? Okay, and the view model goes, I don't know. The developer who wrote me went to great pains and stakes to make sure that I didn't know anything about the view, okay? So you've got this fundamental problem, and actually it's a problem across nearly all of the MVVM providers. So if you go and talk to Loren, who's running MVVM Lite, he's got this problem at the moment. If you talk about MVVM Cross, I don't think that they've addressed this problem. It's actually quite a deep inherent problem in those frameworks, is that they were built by people who understand iOS and Android and Windows Phone that only has one window, okay? We're now back on Windows. Long-lived multiple windows. Okay, continuum and projection are all things that you can now do because we're in a windowed environment and because we're having some high-definition phones that are capable of things like plugging into external displays and things like that. Projection's a nice one. Again, I can't really demo it. There's a great sample there that unfortunately doesn't work particularly well when you're actually projecting slides and things like that. Okay, performance. This is one of the pain areas that you will find when you're doing these really lovely adaptive displays. You will need to spend time dealing with performance. I would avoid getting to the end of a project and going, hey, you know what, we should do some performance testing on what works and what doesn't. Or better still, you get to the end of the project and you go, oh, I've got this brilliant thing, I've tested on the desktop, it works beautifully on the emulator. You put it on a 640 and it goes really slow. And you wonder, ooh, okay, what are we gonna do? Because I've invested like serious amounts of hours getting this beautiful adaptive display to work pixel perfect. And trust me, we did. And then we went to the 640 and we thought that it was all going to be fine and dandy, and page transitions took, well, when we started, they took about a minute. You imagine the user going, did I press that button? And actually one of the feedbacks we had was we had buttons down the bottom that actually transitioned between the pages. And the user would press on the second page, and then there would be two buttons highlighted at one stage. And the feedback from us was, oh, there's two buttons highlighted at the same time. It's like, yeah, the page didn't transition either. Okay, that was the more fundamental problem, let alone the buttons changing color. So make sure you do performance checking early. Okay, there's a few things you can do. There's a few things that Microsoft have done, namely that they've switched from using data binding or traditional data binding. And you love when you get your slides polished by these design people. They kind of move things. Like, if you look at XBind, there's actually no space between the colon and the word bind. And similarly, data binding is actually one word when you put it in the context of code. So Microsoft have said have got this new thing called XBind. So imagine when you press the start key, imagine it took us, say, 3 seconds for the start menu to appear every single time you hit the start button. Or imagine you were in your mail application and it took 10 seconds to switch between mail items. That's the kind of performance that we saw in early iterations of the insider builds for Windows 10. Okay, some of those early applications were so sluggish that you'd go, ooh, what's Microsoft doing? They're eating their own dog food. They're using their own products. They're using XAML just like us. And then they go, ooh, you know that stuff that you've been telling us for like 5 years that's really slow? Hey, it's slow. So they go, okay, well, what's slow about it? And, you know, the .NET Core people going, well, you know this little bit of reflection that you're doing every time you load a value or every time you do data binding or every time something changes and you cause a bit of reflection? Hey, that's really slow. Don't do it. And don't do it again. And really, really don't do it. How many people have reflection in their code? Okay. It's actually one of the coolest parts of the .NET language, right? The ability to do reflection and to dynamically load things. And if you've ever used like a dependency injection framework, quite a lot of those are based on some form of reflection. Now, the good ones are actually getting away from doing that. So you go and create an instance of a type, and it's registered to a particular interface. So there's no longer a need to actually call reflection anymore. They still activate types dynamically, and they do some creative stuff like that, but they actually get away from using reflection because it is inherently slow. okay? And if you've ever done some performance metric, it's on the same scale as throwing an exception. You know how an exception pretty much takes down the entire framework and bubbles it back up again? Okay, don't throw exceptions, don't do reflection, okay? It's as simple as that. But, okay, well, what do we do as developers? Okay, we want to use data binding, which is based on reflection. So let me switch over and we'll talk through an example. All right, so let me close down a few of these. We don't need these anymore. So we'll call this demo no reflection. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm actually going to demonstrate reflection, and I'll actually show you what happens when we do some basic data binding. And as much as anything, you don't really want to see me type an entire view model out, so let me just go and grab this, which I think has got a view model right at the end of it. Okay, let's switch over to my page, my main page. And at the end of here, I normally partition this into a separate file, but for the purpose of this demo, I'm just going to put it in the end of here. Okay, so we've got a very simple main view model. It implements iNotify property change. If you haven't already, create a base class called like Notify Base or something like that that implements this, or go and use one of those MVVM frameworks that already implements iNotify property change and use that as the basis of virtually everything that you create. That way you can raise up property change events and all your binding frameworks will be happy. Okay, so this is very simple. It's got a single property called message, and we've got an infinite loop here, and you can tell this is demo software because we've got a while true. Don't ever do this in production code. But for demo purposes, it's really great because it's going to update the code, and actually, we don't need all of these things on the end there. It's just going to update the second counter over time. We've got this nice on-property change wrapper method there. It just means that it's kind of nice because whenever we call it, we don't need to provide any parameters because it automatically detects what property we're calling from. If you do need to call it from somewhere else, so for example up here, if I wanted to then invoke it like that, I would need to actually specify the property that I want to invoke. There are some nice workarounds here, so for example, that you can add into there. So one of the overrides that I have in my base class for implementing iNotify property change actually uses an expression tree there. And so what that would then mean is that I can then say, okay, well, instead of passing in a string literal, I can actually do that, okay? Whilst this looks really nice and is kind of in the same realms of doing traditional data binding, it is something that you would actually want to avoid because parsing down an expression tree is actually relatively slow, and whilst it's nice from a compiles perspective because you can validate whether you've made any errors in your string logic, it's also not very good from a runtime perspective. Okay, so let's stick with this, and let's actually go and modify my visuals just so we can see the output of that. So I'm going to data bind to a property called message, and let's say that that's, we'll put that in the middle of the screen again, like we did yesterday, and we'll just bump it up a bit in size so we can all see it. And okay, so it should be mostly good. The only the last thing we need to do is actually create an instance of that view model and associate it as the data context for the page. So data context equals new main view model. Right, so we should be good to go. Okay, so we have a basic counter on the screen. Let me switch back into the code, and what I'll do is come down here to our message, and I'll put a breakpoint in there. So what I wanted to show you is basically the code that gets invoked when you actually raise that property change. So you can see this custom property stuff in there. That's pretty much reflection, okay? So it's basically jumping out, it's having to do some weird reflection stuff, and it's basically going to go and retrieve that get value. It's then going to look for any sort of properties that actually use that. So it's kind of another set of reflection that's actually got to try and work out. Now that part is actually a little bit optimized. They actually kind of work out, and they basically build up a dictionary of which values need to be updated or which attributes need to be based on which binding expressions. So that part they've optimized quite well. But the call to actually retrieve this message is actually a reflection call. So it's inherently slow. So let's actually switch this across to using XBind. From a visual perspective in here, from a XAML perspective, let's go and change that to the XBind. Now, what you'll see here is that it's come up with a whole bunch of properties, okay? The first fundamental difference that we had on the slide was that we do not have a data context anymore. We have a context, okay? It's semantics, right? No, it's much more than that, okay? The data context, you set it at the page level, it flows down to every single element. If you don't set it at the page level, it's null, okay? And null flows down to everything. You can set it at whatever level you like, and it inherits to its children. You can override it at whatever level you want, and it updates on all of its children, okay? The data context is the object that you're data binding to, and you're data binding to properties on that object, okay? How many people here understand now what a data context is? Good, excellent. The context is the page or the user control itself, okay? That's weird. Right, so I'm going to be data binding to itself, yeah. Okay, where does this ever make sense? When am I ever going to data bind to elements on the same page? Well, actually, in some scenarios, it does make sense. For example, you could data bind so that if the height of an object changes, you can have elements change. Okay, that's one aspect. Most of the time, for our data binding purposes, what we want to be able to do is data bind to a property on that page that we're going to surface up our data into. So it's a relatively easy change to make from a coding perspective. All we need to do is instead of having this bound to our data context, we need to expose up a property that we're going to data bind to. So let's do that. So public main view model. This will be our view model. And we're going to use nice C-sharp stick stuff. What am I doing here? Right. Let's get it inside the class, not outside it. And we're going to do equals new main view model. And just so I could potentially keep my existing data binding going, I'm actually going to say that this is now equal to my view model, like so. Nope, there's no method on there. Okay. If we switch back now to our XAML, the interesting thing you'll start to see here is that we actually see that property straight away. Okay. It's compile time stuff, right? So what's it actually going to do is it's going to be interrogating that model. It's going to be pulling out the list of properties, and it knows their type, and it knows what attributes that are available, the properties that are available on it. So I can go view model dot message. And the interesting thing there is if I get it wrong, so for example, I leave an extra character on there, when I try and bind it and build it, or even now, you can see that it's squiggled and say, hey, this property's not right. So not only are we solving a problem of performance, we're also solving a problem of getting the data binding right in the first place, okay? Because it's all validated as part of that compile process. So no number of benefits there. Now, what's really interesting thing is let's go and actually run this. You reckon it's going to work? How many people have we got with yes? Okay, well, it seems to be calling something, so let's let that run. Oh, what's going on? Okay, something's not right. Let's put a breakpoint there. Okay, something's really not right. Let's put a breakpoint here and see what's happening. Okay, that's been setting. Okay, and it's going through the next process, so it's raising that proper change. Okay. Can anybody tell me what the default binding mode is for a traditional data binding? One way. Okay. What do you think it's going to be for XBind? Let's talk about performance. Does one way make sense from a performance perspective? We're going to be binding to notify property change of every single element, every single class that we're binding to? No, it doesn't. Okay, so they've said, okay, well, let's prevent developers from shooting themselves in the foot. Let's make it one time by default. And that essentially means that was the first time we actually saw it read the message, and essentially that was before I'd even started updating it. Okay, so let's go back into our code and say, okay, well, this property is actually going to update over time, so we can go mode equals one way. Okay, so now when we run it, it's actually going to run, and we should be in a good state. Okay, so we hit it once, and we hit it twice. All right, let me just let that run, and I'll come back and show you in a second. It's working. Demo gods are with me today. All right, so let me put a breakpoint there, and you'll notice that between on property changed and the getter, which is the same block of code we were looking at before, there's no calls to reflection. It's basically hard-coded logology. Let's go and take a look at that. Okay. It's also no reference to external code. Okay, remember before it was all grayed out? Well, that was external code. Most times you've got that collapsed into one line that says external code. Well, I expanded it so that you could see there was a reflection call. This time, it's your code. Well, actually, it's not kind of your code. It's code that got generated for you, that belongs to you, that gets compiled with your app, that you can then go and debug. Don't go and modify it, because the next time you do a build, it's going to get wiped out. Okay, there's a big statement, at the top of this file that basically says, this is generated code. Changes this file may cause incorrect behavior, and we lost this code regenerate. So basically, don't modify it. But it is interesting, because it'll actually show you a number of things in terms of what you thought your code was going to do and what it is actually doing. Okay, so you might spend a little bit of time going through this and actually working out what's going on. Okay. Okay, so the next thing to think about is, okay, well, that's fine for simple values, but what happens if I want to bind to a list? Okay, so let's think about how we do data binding to a list. Okay, so we'd normally do something like this. On our screen, we'd have a list view, and we might have item source equals, you know, binding my collection. Okay, now inherently that my collection could be untyped because the XAML doesn't really care. Okay, it's gonna, so long as it's enumerable, it can enumerate over the values, it's gonna pull out all of those, it's gonna create you an item container based on the item template, which we haven't defined yet, but we will. It's going to create one of those, and it's going to add it to the list view, and it's going to data bind the object to it. Okay, that's all great in concept, but what happens if I then use xbind here? Okay, so I can do xbind to my collection. Now, the interesting thing there is my type. Okay, that doesn't exist, so I'm going to obviously have to create a property called that on my view model. But when I get down into defining my item template, so I do list view, and you know how long it took me to actually remember the syntax for this stuff? It's taken me 5 years of XAML development before I trusted the tools enough that I'd actually learn the XAML that it was generating. So grid, let's do text block in there, text equals, let's do xbind, so let's do a name property, for example, right? So normally when we're doing data binding, that name property would be bound to our data context, and the data context of every item in the list is, of course, the item that's being presented in the list. That makes sense. What about with xbind? Okay, so we've solved the problem about the fact that it's giving me a squiggle on my collection. We've given it a strongly typed collection. The problem is that the list view isn't smart enough to realize that you're passing in a typed data set. It still thinks you're passing an object. Okay, so there's no way that when we get into the data template that it can go, okay, well, yeah, but you've got an object of type person here. Unless you tell it that way. So what you can do in here is that you can do xDataType equals, and then you can specify in here the type name or the class name of the type that you want to data bind. And that way, at compile time, it can actually generate the appropriate code. It can do the correct validation for you. Now, there's one little extra caveat to this is quite often we like to put these data templates in a style dictionary or a resource dictionary. If you're going to do them in a resource dictionary, you actually need to implement the code behind file, and you actually need to tell it that you're going to load a specific set of data types into there. So there is a little bit of extra things that you need to do in terms of supporting resource dictionaries. If you want to get down to that level, go and look at MSDN. They've got some really good examples of it. Now, the next thing I'm going to do is I'm actually going to create a new sample, and we're going to show you a couple of little tricks around performance, around working with lists and working with adaptive displays. So let me create a new application, and we're going to do this one, a demo lists. And I'm going to come over here, and the first thing I'm going to do is open this in Blend. This list gets longer and longer. There we go, design in Blend. All right, we don't want the app.xaml because that's not really designable. Let's grab my main page. And while Blend catches up, let me solve the problem here. Let's go up here, let's go to our assets window, and we'll start off with two grids. Okay, so Let's just create that in the right spot. Now, these two grids are going to represent my my narrow display and my landscape. So we're going to basically use a couple of visual states to switch between two distinct layouts rather than necessarily hiding and showing elements. So here we're going to just go reset all on both of these. And so the first thing I'm going to do is come up to our data window and I'm going to generate to some sample data. It's going to take a second or two to do. Okay, so we've got some group data there that we can go and we'll add those in a second. The first thing we're going to do in here, and I'll do it quicker in code than I can using the designer, is I'm going to do a grid view in here. And in the next one, I'm going to do a list view. And so essentially, we're going to show the same set of data in these. You can imagine here, grid view is when we've got a large, big display, we've got things horizontally scrolling. Narrow display, portrait display, we're going to do a list view type display. So let me grab the groups and I'm going to drag those onto here. Set that as the item source so you can see in my designer I've now got things appearing there. Let's just change that to a desktop layout. Okay, so we can see a grid view there. Let's just do the same again but for our list view. Okay, so we're going to get overlapping things. One of the guidances I would suggest that you do is if you've got a lot of these adaptive displays, the first thing you want to do is actually set all of the visibility to collapsed, okay, and then you go and create your visual states for actually transitioning to them. So these are going to be my layout states, so I'm going to have two, the same as I did yesterday. This is going to be my narrow, and this is going to be my wide. And I don't know whether anybody was really astute enough to pick it out yesterday, but actually, I was relying on some default behavior of the fact that I hadn't actually set the adaptive trigger for the narrow display, and it was actually by pure chance that it actually worked, because you actually do need to tell it to go into the adaptive, into the narrow display. So if I currently, if I'd run it the way I've just done, so I've only done the adaptive trigger for the wide display, what will happen is it'll go nicely into the wide display, but it will never transition back into the narrow display. Okay, so I'm going to create the same adaptive trigger, but this time I'm going to specify those as zeros. And so that's my narrow display. What essentially I want to do is, when I'm in my narrow display, I want to show my list view, so I'll set that to visible. When I'm in my wide display, I want to show the grid view. Let's go and check that's going to look all right. So we'll go ahead and run that. So it's deployed. Now hopefully Blender will start to run it. And so there's our grid view, and hopefully if we resize it enough, we should see it switch to our list view. It's not going to let me resize it any further down. That's weird. Pretty certain I didn't specify a minimum width there. Okay. So let's just actually verify that. I'm not quite sure why it's not switching those properly. What I do want to show you, though, is on our visual tree, we can see. So this is our live visual tree, right? So we've got these really cool tools that actually allow us to show these visual elements. So if I go and say, hey, I want to actually select them, I can actually get a selection border over there, and it'll actually find the appropriate element in here. Okay, so this is the actual live visual tree, and I can go and modify the live properties on the right-hand side. This is in both Blender and Visual Studio. It's a really nice tool if you haven't already seen it. Let me just close that up again. Let me just close down our grid view. What we'll see here is that we've both got the grid view and the list view. Now, what's interesting here is our list view hasn't actually been populated, but it is still there in our visual stack, okay, which means that it's taking up resources. It means it's loading in the background. So that's not great, because imagine that applied to a much more complex display. Grids and list views are actually quite performant, right? So if you're only rendering things in lists and controls like that, the performance is generally pretty okay. What gets really hairy is if you've got much more complex displays and you're switching between three or four of those using visual states. There's a nice couple of attributes that you can learn to use that actually allow you to defer the loading of certain XAML. So let me come down here, and I'm going to put in here a tag called X defer load strategy, and I'm going to say lazy, because as developers, we're all inherently lazy. We like to write minimal amount of code. All right, let me just run that up, and hopefully what we should see in our apply property tree is that we shouldn't see that list view until it actually gets created. So here, see how we've got our grid view, but we don't actually have our list view. Okay, so that's one of those attributes that you can then use. There are definitely some edge cases to using this. So for example, if you want to reference this list view from your code behind, let's do that right now. Let's actually stop it in Blend first. So the problem is that value of x is null, right? So that backing variable, normally would almost be 100% that those backing variables actually get populated with the appropriate element on the screen. The challenge here is that though we've now got variables in the code behind that don't necessarily get loaded all the time. So what we have to do in order to get it to load is basically list view equals this dot find name, and then we say list view. Right, and of course, all of a sudden, we're introducing string literals as list view. Can anybody tell me what this is actually going to do by calling find name on it? Sorry? Yeah, it's going to actually load that in the instance of that variable, right? So if I actually look at my visual tree now, which it's not going to because I'm in debug, let's actually run that. And let's switch back to my visual tree. You'll actually see that it's loaded it. Okay, so the call to, those elements can be loaded two ways. So either you change to a visual state that actually requires that element. And the thing to be careful of there is that the visual state actually needs to name that element. Okay, so you need to say list view, and then you set the visibility property on it to visible. And okay, that element then gets created, loads, and then you can reference it in the code behind. The other way is to actually call this find name property. Things to be aware of, if you've got named elements that are underneath those ones where you've got the defer strategy, they don't get automatically populated into the backing variables. So as a general rule, I don't name elements unless I really, really need to, or unless a visual state needs them. Okay. So that's rule number one. Rule number two is if you are naming things and they're further down the tree, just be careful because you can shoot yourself in the foot if you're trying to reference them or to use them anywhere before they're instantiated. So we've actually got a very crude helper extension method that essentially wraps a call to find name, because you can do things like, so for example, you can now do, I think it's just like name of. Okay, so that gets rid of the string literals in your code, and then you can have sort of helper methods that work around that to give you a backing variable, like an instance variable of the particular things anyhow. So, let me just switch to the slides. I think there was one other thing I wanted to cover. No, that's pretty much it. All right, hopefully you've all learned something out of today's session. Hopefully you're all eager to get to the party. Otherwise, you can hang around and ask me questions. Okay, thanks very much, guys. If you don't, you'll start back through.
Ocean blue, what have I done to you? Cut so deep, yet growing through and through. Too late. What would you say? What would you say? What would you?